Blog Talk Radio.
Sunday afternoon, everyone. This is Down South and Dirty with Scout Smith and Stacey Hopkins. And today, we will be talking about third parties, the red-headed stepchildren of the political process here in America. Also today with us, I think we've got the call already in, is Doug Craig, who is the former chair of the Libertarian Party of Georgia. And I want to thank Doug. Doug, that is you, right?
Yes, sir, it is.
Hey, and I would like to thank Doug because
you're little redheaded stepchild.
But we love
literally.
You. You're still part of the family.
Literally.
Are you are you literally a redhead?
Yes, and I've got a house full of redheaded.
Oh, that's perfect. That is beautiful. But we're glad you could join us today. That's funny.
Yeah.
When we hit on the mark, we hit it on the mark, huh?
It's kind of significant that Doug is on the show today because a year ago, Down South and Dirty started. And the first guest on Down South and Dirty was Doug Craig talking about the Libertarian Party. So, you know, what goes around comes around, and Doug and I are still friends after a year of political thuggery and all the other stuff that goes on in Georgia. We're still friends. So let's jump right into this. Doug, since you're the former chair of the Libertarian Party here in Georgia, tell us, what is the goals and aims of the Libertarian Party here in Georgia?
Well, you know, I got lucky. I sat on our national board a few years ago, and I sat with the actual founder of the party, a guy named David Nolan. And one of the things he wanted to tell folks, our goal was never to be elected. Our goal was to change America, to move towards freedom, to move towards liberty. A lot of times people get confused, and they think the goal of running for office is to win. It's not. It's to change the mindset. It's to change what's actually going on. Sometimes you can actually make a change without ever winning. And our goal was to make a change. The Supreme Court making marriage equal for everybody. You know, that's something the libertarians have been fighting for 40 years, for marriage equality. We've never been elected yet. We think we had a hand in making that change. And for us, I think going forward, that's still our change. We would love equal ballot access, but at the end of the day, we got to remember not to sell our soul for elections, but only to go out there and work for freedom and equality and liberty.
Wow. I think a lot of groups, and certainly the Libertarian Party has been one, that's a lot of that have been fighting for marriage equality. And I think it's important, particularly minorities, to understand that even though we may not see eye to eye with the whole Libertarian platform, that there are places where we do find common ground. And we, you know, it's like you don't have to marry the person. But, you know, this is ways of using our collective power in order to get change. So I thank everybody who was instrumental in the Libertarian Party to help see what we saw go on from the Supreme Court. But we also have to remember that we're just talking about marriage equality, because you could get married, put your picture of your spouse up at work here in Georgia and get fired for it. So we still got some work to do.
And one of the things that you know, and I was glad that, you know, Doug brought this point to him, that because me being a Democrat, and I know my Republican counterparts kind of think the same sometimes, is that it's in our platform to elect people to office. We are about winning. And sometimes I guess we get upset with the third party because I don't think the Libertarian Party is the only party that has the same thought process. Is that we're just trying to make change because I always have to, in my talking to Doug, I think sometimes the Libertarians understand that how much of a battle it would be to supplant either the Republican or Democratic Party, so the best you can hope for sometimes is to get us to move in a particular direction. And see that on a regular basis, even when you talk about some of the left-wing third parties, you talk about the Greens, the Democratic Socialists. We all look at them sometimes and be like, you know what, these folks ain't trying to win an election. But what they're attempting to do sometimes is get those of us who are a little bit more moderate than they are, like in the Democratic Party, to look and say, hey, these people may be right on this issue, and we need to go look at that. What you think, Doug?
Look, I go out there. I've ran three times, and I'm one of the few people in Georgia that's ran for state house as a third-party candidate. And in Georgia, they make it nearly impossible. I always tell folks, you think you have the right to vote, but when you don't have the right for the selection process to go the way it does, you really don't have the right to vote. I mean, we get two choices for state house. In Cuba, they get one. In France, they get 20. You know, look how close we are to being more like Cuba and Ecuador than we are, you know, the rest of the European countries that have true freedom. You know, and what happens is they shut us out of the debate. Georgia has one of the worst ballot access laws in America. We have not seen a U.S. House third-party candidate here since 1943. So what happens is we get shit out of the debates, and guess what? The two big parties, they get to talk about the same thing. It's, you know, it's black, white for them. We like to come in there and talk about the, you know, some of the other issues and move that debate. But when we're shut out of it, that doesn't happen. And I will tell you, I lobbied this year. They had a ballot bill. Ed Reiner was the chairman of the committee that was in charge of it, basically told me I didn't have nothing to give to him to get that bill out of his committee. He basically said, look, Doug, what can you give us? I don't want to debate you. I don't want to have you up here debating against me. Unless you have something to give me, I'm not giving it. He said, don't give me this Thomas Jefferson, this George Washington, Abraham Lincoln freedom stuff. He said, what can you give me? I want something in return. I said, I don't have nothing to give you. I'm not that kind of guy. You should do it because it's the right thing. But he basically said he doesn't do it for the right thing. He does it for power.
One of the things, we did have some attempts to bring ballot access, because that is one of the biggest challenges that third parties face. If you're running to get on the congressional ticket, if you're running for Congress, you're going to need, I think it's about 18,000 signatures. And I think for a county commissioner or governor, it's 180 days. You have a certain time frame to get that done, and it's not insurmountable, but it's a very daunting challenge for a lot of these third parties to bring about. And there have been some attempts to bring some half-hearted attempts by the Georgia legislature to bring about some change, but we really haven't seen anything that's effective in reducing the requirements for third-party candidates. Doug, what do you think can be, what do you have some recommendations on what the two parties can do, even though they really have, it's not in their best interest to have third parties on the ballot, but what do you
think? Well, there is actually, you know, there's something they do in New York, which is kind of neat, where you can run as what's called a fusion candidate. And what you can do is you can be endorsed by the Democratic Party, or you can go run as a Democrat and then get endorsed by the Libertarian. And when you would be on the ballot, you would be a Libertarian Democrat or a Libertarian Republican, which then allows you to be endorsed by two different parties. And that would be one way that it wouldn't split the vote that these guys were about and reduce their power. Because I have to tell you, in the third party world, we tend to have Republican-leaning Libertarians, Democrat-leaning Libertarians. And I think that would be one way. Another one would be, just, you know, reduce the requirement of the signatures from 5% to 1%. When I ran in Clayton County, I had to have 2,000 signatures. It took 4 months of going door to door. And by the way, which was really an exciting moment, when you go up to a lady's house and you knock on the door, she's 63 years old, and she said, you are the first person to ever ask me for a vote. That's 63. And And she had grew up in Clay County like I had, and she says, nobody has ever been to my door. She says, every time the assumption was I was going to vote a certain way, she says, you got my vote just because you came by. I mean, it was really some neat stuff when you are forced to go out and get door-to-door signatures. But everybody else is at the VFW. Everybody else is at the debates, doing the interviews, and we're out hitting the pavement in July and August in the state of Georgia, trying to get on the ballot. And one of the neat things that did come of Clayton County run, we had a fellow by the name of John Mons, who ran for PSC a few years ago. He actually won Clayton County. He beat, there was only two people in the race, and we actually won that county in a statewide race, which was kind of neat. For the Libertarian, that's going to get more votes than the other candidate.
I'm a big fan of the bottom-up strategy. I'm a big fan, so, you know, I've got my activist roots, and I'm a big fan of hearing bottom-up strategy and also, you know, making that face-to-face connection, because there's nothing like it. That is the most important method of getting out the vote, is meeting those voters. And like you said, when you knock on somebody's door and they're just delighted that you're there, there's something to it. So,
I think there's an assumption by the folks that are in power that we're not smart enough to handle more than two people. You know, the fact is, when me and you go down on the cereal aisle and there's 42 choices, you know what we say? Oh, my, this is awesome. I love capitalism. I love free market. I love 42 choices. For some reason, our governor, our past governors, all thought we were too stupid to handle more than two options, that we wouldn't be able to go out and do this research. And I think at the end of the day, that's where the libertarians differ. We trust the voter to make an educated choice. Doesn't always work that way, but generally speaking, I have to make the assumption that you guys, I know, my neighbor knows who they're voting for and why they're voting. And I think sometimes the GOP in particular wants to pigeonhole people and force them into a certain hole. And I think that's what comes out of it at the end of the day.
You know, in the end of, kind of to piggyback on that, you're absolutely right, because you get a lot, you know, you hear it very vocally. In the Republican Party, the GOP says it very vocally. You know, all they use the word informed voter or low information voter. Like, okay, low information voters, basically you're saying that we're stupid, that we don't go, that people with the people who go vote for very, you know, shallow reasons. And the majority of people that I meet that vote, seeing that the voting turnout in America ain't the greatest in the world. Most people who go out and vote usually have a very good reason for why they're voting the way they're voting, regardless if you agree with it or not. Now some people may say some superficial stuff, like I know black people who say, "Oh, I voted for Obama because I wanted a black president." But then if you continue the conversation with them about, okay, what are the other things that you like about Obama? You will hear the questions. You'll hear the answers of, oh, he was for, you know, universal health care, or he was for this, or he was for that. And you can hear those things. But the first thing that comes out of their mouth, according to who they're talking to, is that. And the answers come based on who they're talking to. And the media, we can't always trust the media to give us a straight story, because we know that that stuff can be cut and edited and on the floor. So what you hear on the news always, maybe you get a sound like you're getting a low information voter, but we didn't hear the whole interview. That's one of the reasons this show this week is on third party and not on the flag or marriage equality or anything like that, because sometimes the whole story is the story is best told from another perspective. And like you said early on, the Libertarian Party, and I know there's a couple of issues in which Democrats and Libertarians are like in lockstep with, but we don't even take the time to talk to each other about them. And marriage equality was one. Ending the war on drugs is another. Ending mass incarceration. Bringing troops home. All of these issues that you talk to the average Democratic voter, they're like, those are some hot button issues for us. But we don't even take the time when we're out there going knocking on doors. Majority of us aren't taking the time to go talk to our Libertarian buddies. Now, I know when a couple of races that I have dealt with personally running, that I have reached out and had my candidates reach out to Libertarian voters on issues that I know that was important to them, and we got their vote. We may have didn't win, but we got some libertarian voters, some libertarian support. Why? Because we thought on the same line of some issues. I mean, it's just crazy. And you got the Republicans doing the same thing. They would rather fight the libertarians and try to make the Libertarian Party seem like, you know, you're doing such a disservice to the conservative, particularly when we're talking about financial conservatism, that you're doing such a disservice to it. But at the same time, they won't come talk to you knowing doggone well libertarians don't like taxes. Don't you know that certain things that libertarians...
You know, it's funny. Go ahead. John Yates, who's, I think, the oldest guy we have sitting in office, I think he was born in like 1843 or something. But a few years ago, it's probably about 15 years ago, I was living in Henry County, and he told me, "We got two parties, Mr. Craig, and you need to get under one of the tents." Well, then all of a sudden, a fellow by the name of Ron Paul came about. And all of a sudden, all my libertarian buddies ran to the GOP. Well, then all of a sudden, the people like John Yates started saying, "You guys got your own party. Leave our party alone," because they were starting to take it over. Then they started freaking out. They actually shut down the Athens-Clark County GOP convention because the libertarians had come in there and were starting to take over. Mm-hmm. It was amazing how hateful, at the point they started realizing that we were talking true liberty, they did not want us in their party. They want crony capitalism. They liked it. They liked the power. And they were amazed when our guys were showing up. And they're like, "We actually want to make a difference. We're not here to play with the country club boys. We're here to actually get equality, to get lower taxes, to get more freedom." And they're like, "Well, what are we going to do about that government contract? We want less government contracts." And all of a sudden, we weren't as welcome as they once told us we were.
And that comes to the problem, and I wish somebody, we had some of my Greens and Democratic Socialist Party people, because I know they feel the same way about the Democratic Party.
Well, we're seeing that with the Bernie Sanders race. I mean, we've got that, the dynamics with, you know, Ron Paul on the right, forcing or bringing a libertarian shift to the GOP, and then we see Bernie Sanders doing similar for progressives, and I think it's an alignment of the parties who I think most people feel have gotten out of the way, because, I mean, over 50% of people of the public when polled agree that we should have an inclusion of third parties, but you have the two major parties holding the gauntlet and preventing them from being participatory in the electoral process.
Because I don't see any time soon, I'm going to be honest, I don't see any time soon where any of the third parties, as we're calling them, will become dominant enough to supplant either the Republican or Democratic parties, at least in the next 20 years. But the thing is, like you said, But like you're saying, though, they are making an influence on the two parties from the inside, because you have people joining who are deciding, "Hey, I'm going to get involved in the process," just like Doug said. They went to the Republican convention. Now, what would happen at the DPG if the Democratic Socialists and Greens would get the chip off their shoulder and show up and attempt to play on Team Blue? You know, all of our party meetings and state committee meetings are open to the public. Now, you can't vote in them because that's the way our bylaw, but you can sit back and observe. You can sit back and get to know the people in your room, in the room, who represent your precinct or your district or whatever. You can get to know who these people are. You can go to your county party meeting and find out, because, I mean, there has been some things that I've that I hear sometimes from on the left that are disheartening. I mean, we got people who can't even post challenges to our chair on Facebook about his voting record when he was a state House representative. There was a particular individual, I'm not going to put, to protect the innocent, I'm not going to say any name, but we had a particular individual who is a Democrat, a progressive, who asked DuBose Porter, and DuBose, I love you, and then you'd be nice for you to answer this question, because you may have evolved.
I don't know if he loves you. He ain't going to love you after this.
But you know, there's some questions that you need to, you know, the question was asked. You know, over this Confederate flag flap, you know, DuBose, you voted. to keep the original 54 flag. At least that's what they say. I haven't seen the. This is what was said. I haven't looked at your voting record in particular. So let me make that disclaimer. I have not looked at this. I'm just saying the story. I ain't a journalist. I'm relaying the story. I'm not a journalist. I'm just relaying the story. So I ain't got to be truthful in this. I'm just telling you what folks say. They said that you voted for the 54 flag. And this person put this up, and they were pressured by members of our party to take this thing down, to take this post down. When in the hell, excuse my language, did we become a freaking dictatorship? What happened to the First Amendment? Why can't I, if you are an elected member of my party and I vote for you, why can't I ask you where you stand on the issue and why are your people, you didn't personally tell them to take it down, but why are your people being so anal about questions being asked? This is why people flock to third parties. This is why you have dissension on the right with the Republican Party inside of their ranks and dissension on the left in the Democratic Party with inside their ranks, is because leaders do not want to follow the rank and file.
Well, Scout, I think you're actually onto something here. I think one of the things that happens is if they had more competition, they couldn't control their party. There was a Green Party that was strong in Georgia. They would have to worry about the competition from their left flank. And without that competition, guess what? DeBose gets to run the show like he sees it. The same thing goes on the GOP. They run it like they see it because there's no competition. They've used the force of law to make sure there's no competition. So once they get that powerful position, you know, that position where everybody's like, oh, look, there's the chairman. They want to keep it. They like the power. They like, you know, being up there in charge. And they want to make sure folks like me don't have a chance to break into it. And they want to make sure that they keep you in that line. They want to make sure that you have no option. When you have no option, you stick around in the Democratic Party and you keep feeding them money, you keep feeding them votes, you keep feeding them power. And that's
what
happens.
They use the politics of fear to keep the rank and file in line, because we often hear, well, if you don't vote for this person, like, you know, Republicans will say, well, if you don't vote for this, the Democrat is going to, you know, get into office and, you know, all life as we know it will cease to exist. And we hear vice versa on the other side. And people buy into that. So, and it's very deceptive where they throw the boogeyman. You know, the boogeyman is this nefarious kind of entity, and they avoid talking about the actual issues. And it's very, very frustrating because one of those boogeymen has been Ralph Nader, you know, with the Democrats, when you bring up Al Gore's election. And it's been a long-running myth, you know, about, well, you know, Gore would have won if it was Nader didn't steal the vote. And that's simply not true, you know. But that's what the Democratic Party wants you to believe.
And we've had the same issue. We've seen the same issue in Republican politics, maybe not on the national level. Because, see, on the national level, everybody jump in the race they want to. But on the local level, you will see it, particularly in red counties. You will see on the local counties, you see an establishment Republican and a Tea Party Republican run against it. But if you get a Liberty Republican jumps in the race, everybody turns their eye to that one Republican and they try to destroy him. Oh, you're going to take votes away from us and this, that, and the other, and the Democrats are going to win. And usually ain't but one of us running in a red county somewhere, if we run it at all. And they are scared that, because usually if there's nothing but Republicans running, Democrats will start looking for the lesser of the evils.
I'll tell you something I think is very funny. It's when the GOP kept telling everybody, you got to vote for our presidential candidate to make sure our Supreme Court justices get appointed. And guess what happened when you got your Supreme Court guys? It didn't turn out like you thought. So guess what? This year when you tell us we got to vote for you because of Supreme Court justices, we're going to laugh at you. We're going to point at you. And something I have not been telling many folks out loud, Scout, is more than likely I will be our governor candidate in the state of Georgia for the Libertarian Party in 2.5 years. I'm going to run for governor, for real?
We got a group of scoop here on Downsizing Daily. We got exclusive scoop. We know who's running for the Libertarian Party in 2018.
You know
got
what?
It right
and
in
I
front.
Hope, and I hope I have competition. I do not want it to be just Doug Craig up in the Libertarian, you know, debate.
You want
there to be three.
You want to be a primary.
I want a primary. And, you know, we do primaries a little different, but I want it to be, you know, we lock ourselves in a room, we start debating, and when we walk out at the end of the night, we have our candidate. That's how we do it. If you're
you
a party
know,
member, you show up at the convention.
I mean, the Democratic Party leans so much towards anarchy. It's so difficult to get anything done. And I have to admire libertarians and, well, the right side of the aisle, because you guys, in terms of organizing and focusing, I mean, even though you do have your problems, you guys are light years ahead of the left, and it's very, very, very frustrating for me. I mean, I represent more of the activist background, but you just won so many cool points with me when you said you welcome the competition. I think, you know, and that's something that we've been going through, you know, on the left with the lack of debate for the Democratic candidates. You know, Hillary is the presumptive nominee. That's the constant phrase used.
You saw it here in Georgia. You saw it in Georgia on the governor and the Senate race. You saw it there.
Right.
You know,
and
people basically came in.
And it's ironic to have a party that say you're out to protect and defend my vote, but you subvert it, and you actually take away my choices. And it's not really an election; it's a hostage crisis, and that's not supposed
to be. I'm gonna tell you guys what, and this is one thing that, you know, I've told many of my fellow political operatives and strategists, is that when it comes, choices are good because iron sharpens iron. If you go out and you got to spar with another Democrat in a primary, you have to spar with another Republican in a primary, all you're doing is sharpening your skills and getting your battle training for the general election. And the same thing goes on when we got third parties. All they do is like in Christianity, apologetics. Apologetics is something inside of Christianity that I love, because what it does is it allows me to be able to defend my faith. And when I'm able to defend my faith, then I become stronger in my faith. And it should be the same thing in politics. When I'm able to go out and defend my policies and my platform against people who are opposing me in my policies and platform, and I can come out on top, or I can feel like I can hold my own in that argument, it strengthens my place in that platform decision. But see, when you don't feel confident in your position, then guess what happens? You don't want anybody to challenge it.
It is a rarity for me to block. I run the Georgia Libertarian Facebook page. It is a rarity for me to block someone on our Facebook page.
Amen.
It is a rarity for me to block someone on my personal page. By the way, the Georgia Libertarian Facebook page is 10 times more active than the Georgia Democratic Facebook page. We have 10 times the activity, because if you subscribe, you can see the numbers. And literally, we have 10 times more activity. And I think part of that is that debate. But, you know, one of the cool things is Scout, one of our mutual friends, Ms. Kendricks, the State House rep. The other day, we were having a good debate, friendly debate. And she's like, we were talking about women's rights. And she says, And she's like, your daughter can be anything she wants. And I waited a few minutes. I came back. I said, you know, Ms. Kendricks, I went and told my daughter that, and she said she wanted to be the first elected Libertarian State House woman ever. And then I had to tell her that the Democrats had written laws to make sure that she couldn't get on the ballot, that that was not an option for her. And Ms. Kendricks sent me back a message. She said, you know what, Doug, you're right. I will sponsor your bill for ballot access. And that was because of friendly, good debate. Nothing mean, no bad words, just literally a discussion that led to the opening of people's eyes to what's going on. And you have to have that, because both sides learn sometimes. It ain't just, you know, you're just not trying to teach. You've got to be listening, because you're going to learn something too. And it was awesome for that to be happening. And, you know, I used to be that hardcore neocon, you know, that you guys would have probably hated 30 years ago. And then all of a sudden you wake up and you have these discussions, and you're like, oh, my God, I'm a moron. Why would I think that? You know, and the guy points out, like a scout might be talking on his Facebook, and you're like, I never looked at it from that perspective. and you wake up and you go home at night and you sleep on it and you realize, oh, my gosh, this guy's right and I'm wrong, and you change. And if you don't have that extra voice, that third voice, that fourth voice, you don't learn, and you end up being that closed-minded person forever.
And that's why the American republic and the democracy, which it is formed of, that, you know, the democratic principles of that republic, are so in jeopardy right now, because what we do is we have two sides that are arguing with one another, but the argument is really a farce, because we look at things like TPP, and you had a couple of Democrats right up, you know, going to rebellion about this. And all of a sudden, those Democrats get attacked for standing against the president because we believe he was wrong on this one. And all of a sudden, it's like we committed acts of blasphemy and heresy because we said, Mr. Obama, President Obama, you are wrong. Then we come in, you see the same on the GOP side, you see where some of those people are up in the upright because, hold on, y'all agreed with President Obama on TPP. And when you talk to the American public, all of us are like, what is TPP? Why are y'all voting for it and we still don't know what it is? And you got the common man saying, hold on, you need to slow down and explain this to us so that if it is something good, we can buy in. Because it may actually be something that will benefit us, but we don't know. And obviously, if you don't tell me, it can't benefit me.
Because we all know we're going. They're there to maintain power and position. It doesn't matter what's good for us. And what you heard come up from the people, and this is the will of the people that we're hearing, that we see and hear every day. But the higher you go, the more tone deaf they get because they're not listening to us. And this is why we need more inclusion of other voices and third parties to force that change internally. But who knows? Maybe we might see a Green Party president. We might see a Justice Party president. We'll never know if they never have the opportunity to get there. And to me, ballot access is one of those issues where we can help have a more democratic process. I tend to shy away from using the word that we're a democracy because we're not. We are certainly not a democracy. We use democratic process, but we are not a democracy. But having these other voices in would help do that. And we've got two major parties that are sitting there like a block of government cheese in somebody's colon.
It is amazing how much it costs. Our national party, how much we spend to do ballot access. Right now in Oklahoma alone, our national party is spending $150,000 in Oklahoma to get on the ballot for president. It is amazing. And up there, we're actually teaming up with the Green Party. We're actually carrying both signatures door-to-door with the Green Party to help split the work up. So we'll help get their candidate on, and we'll help get our candidate on. But that is a large chunk of budget for anybody to spend
right.
on a small state like Oklahoma. Even if we were to win it, would we get 3 electoral college votes out of that one?
No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, in Oklahoma, you might. He was asking, saying something about getting the 3 electoral votes out in Oklahoma, if they was able to, you know, if they was able to get the certain percentage of the vote, because you know Georgia's a winner takes all state.
Yeah.
So
it's amazing, and then they have.
Well, we have to keep in mind when we're talking about presidential elections, it's all about math. It's really not about the popular right. vote. That's why you know we talk about battleground states. We're really battling. It's really an election that pivots on, you know, whichever state play in the electoral map. And it's going to be the ones with the biggest election, whichever one will get you to that point.
And I'm going to tell y'all, explain this to y'all. You know, when you look at the two-party system, now both all state parties want their state to become a battleground state. Because there's a financial motivation for that.
And money.
See, this is when it comes, there's money that's going to come in because the battleground state money is going to flow in. If it really doesn't matter if your state, you know, goes one way or the other, no money comes in. I mean, you see more money flowing to Iowa and New Hampshire than a little bit. Okay, and South Carolina Democratic Party is a strong party because it's usually the first in the South. So everybody now wants to go into an SEC primary, hoping that all this money will come into the South and, you know, fuel the political machine. Now, as a political operative, that is great. That is money coming in, and hopefully I can gather a piece of the pie. But as an American citizen, I'm looking at it from the point of view of how my system works in favor of our people. It doesn't do that. It is not something that favors us as an American electorate, because nobody's going to listen to us because we don't have enough money to buy into the system. So my voice is mute because somebody else has more dollars than I have.
Well, to give you an idea, like when the Libertarian Party, we try to go out there and get our message out. Our total budget is $2 million for the whole nation, $2 million. So imagine if you were a Koch brother, you're spending $2 million per state. You might be spending $2 million per city to get your message out as you want to see it and change minds and ideas. And it's amazing how quick a few folks can change our minds with a couple of billion bucks being spent on their behalf.
We like flashy commercials. We like political swag and chum, you know, cool websites, you know, we like all of that stuff because it's like this. We all know if you get something shiny and put it in front of the American people, it's like, ooh, think about it. Every year Apple comes out with a brand new iPhone. People standing in line around the corner to get the next iPhone or the next Samsung Galaxy whatever or whatever it is, the newest thing, and people stand around the line. So but in America, we do that same thing in politics. We put something brand new and shiny. It used to be that you may have one candidate in that party who will run 4, 5, 6 times for president. And eventually, the way the system used to work, that person may end up being the nominee because of name recognition. Now, you run twice. If you lose, you're no longer politically viable. We need something new and fresh and shiny to put up in front of the American people. But the sad thing is, in the political process, nobody lines up around the corner for this brand new shiny thing because it really isn't all that wonderful. So, I mean, the last time we had people standing in lines around corners, hey, it was Obama. Brand
well,
new shiny.
Well, I mean, money in politics, that's something that I've worked on for a few years. And here's the thing. There's a really easy, quick and easy way to disarm money in politics. But I don't think America is ready for it. Stop buying what the money sells. Now, Scout, you and I know from going through a Senate campaign, the first thing we heard, you can't win unless you have $1 million in the bank, right? But let's look at what the money actually buys. It buys those commercials that most people hate and don't really listen to, and that political strategists are not very apt to tell you don't really move a person to vote for that person. If anything, it turns people off. But most of the candidates raise, and these mega candidates that raise this mega money, they spend millions. This will be a $1 billion election on the presidential level. On advertising,
you guys know how much of a kickback you get when you bring the ads to Comcast?
Yeah.
It's 15%.
I know what it is. I'm not leave it alone, though. I'm going to leave it alone, but I know that's what I'm saying.
You really don't need money in politics as we're being told what that money's for.
If you put your money into a good field game, okay, well, that makes sure you either got volunteer canvassers that you're paying for their gas and you're feeding them and making sure they can stay out in the field as long, or you're using that to pay canvassers to go out and knock on doors and talk directly to the people. If you put your money there, it has way more bang for the buck than any commercial, any mailer, or any robocall or telephone call you can make. But see, the thing is that money then flows out into the economy. Because in the field game, money flowing into the field game flows into the economy. Because if you're doing volunteer camps in our field game, then you're paying for gas, which goes to the, you know, to the local gas stations. If you're buying food for your people, you're just going to the local restaurants. It's fueling their situation. And if you're paying canvassers, then what you're doing is creating jobs, which then for a little bit of time, because canvassers get paid pretty decent. Then you're fueling
well,
the economy.
No. Canvassers, you know, there are people out there champions for $15 in the union, and canvassers get paid less than that. Canvassers average
it's according to what group you're dealing with, because I've always dealt with when I've canvassed, and I'm paying canvassers, or I've been with groups that are paying canvassers, I might not be paying 15, but you're getting more than 10.
Well, you know, guys, I tell you what's kind of funny on the, you know, I was chair during the Amanda Swafford campaign, the Hunt campaign, and we actually bought some TV ads and some radio ads this past time. And we actually got a little bit of media coverage and TV coverage, but part of that is, part of it was pay to play. All of a sudden, a guy called up to me one day, just out of the blue, says, "Hey, I see you've been buying radio ads. So when are you going to buy one on my station?" I was like, "Well, when are you going to start interviewing my candidates?" "Well, if I interview your candidate, will you buy some ads?" And I'm like,
"Exactly.
You're a news station. You should be interviewing my candidate because they're polling at 9% in a race that's supposed to be one of the ones that could decide who's going to win Senate. You know, I shouldn't have to be paying you $1,000 in TV ads and radio ads to make sure I get an interview." But that's basically what he was telling me is, "Hey, look, you buy ads, you get TV time."
The same thing happened in the ad campaign. People will come to us because this is the thing. They will look. Everybody has the ability to look at what money you're bringing in. Everybody can see. Because you can go in, you can see what money is. And people will call and say, "Hey, you want to buy an ad?" And they were alpha. You know what I'm saying? Hey. But see, Dr. Rad was not one of those pay-to-play fellas. He wasn't going to do it. He didn't believe that that was going to happen. He wasn't paying nobody to play. But we understood it. And, you know, leading that campaign, I kind of had mixed feelings about that because I knew that we supposed to pay to play. But at the same time, I understood that the man had a conviction.
And that was, there was mad respect for him for that. I had mad respect for him for that.
And because of that, I had to respect his conviction. You know, there's a lot of stuff that we offered him as a campaign team to do. And Stacey remembers this because she was there with us for a point of time. There was a lot of stuff we asked him to do. And he was like, "Listen, it goes against what I believe in." And we were sitting around mad. "God, this guy don't want to win. Da 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 da." But he was standing his ground on what he believed in. And where you had our opposition, we're willing to take him by the kitchen sink, throw the kitchen sink out the door, and throw it on top of your mother's head to make sure that they got as much airtime as they needed and still lost.
You know,
because
guys,
they
it's
never
funny.
Got the people.
But it's kind of good that you guys have this debate. I don't know if you know, in the past we've been right on the verge of qualifying for federal matching funds for a presidential race. We actually have a large faction of our party members who will not vote for a presidential candidate who is willing to take the matching fund.
Wow.
That can actually be a game changer at our convention. If you're willing to take the matching funds, our people will not vote for you.
And, you know, we can talk. I mean, that was one of the things that was a disappointment when President Obama rejected that during his presidential campaign. And, you know, although we had a lot of, you know, small donors, it began an escalating arms race in terms of money in the presidential race. And I find it ironic that Democrats make a part of it as their platform, that they're going to get money out of politics and then turn around and use the same methods and tactics that they claim to be against. And I think that is one of the ways where they help subvert and suppress the voices of third parties, money and politics. And we've got to, you know, that's why this so important to me, you know, getting money out of politics. And it's one of the most ones that bring out cognitive dissonance in the electorate, and also is one of the most important things that we need to address. I'd like to I'd like to ask you, Doug, about some of the challenges that Libertarian Party candidates have faced in Georgia, just getting on the ballot. How difficult is it?
I'll tell you at least two good examples. I ran in 2002, and we'd got our signatures done, and we handed them down to the Secretary of State. And we get a call on Friday going, hey, look, there's a problem. Right now we're disqualifying you, but Monday we'll sit down and we'll look at this and we'll get it back on track. Well, we don't know a whole bunch about this because we don't run a whole bunch of candidates because we're not allowed to. Well, we didn't realize if we didn't challenge that within 24 hours, that ruling became set in stone. Luckily, somebody called us and said, look, guys, y'all need a challenge. We challenged it Friday afternoon, and Monday they went ahead and said, oh, you're right, we made a mistake. But if we hadn't have called them until Monday afternoon, we would have been automatically knocked off the ballot. Jeff Aveson ran this past time. When I got all the signatures, now his wife carried petitions, but at the end when they were done, she also notified part of the signatures that people got, but not the ones that she carried. And they said because she had carried and notarized, all her signatures were knocked out. So Jeff Aveson, in a very tight race, was bumped off the ballot last year because of that. We probably spent, you know, 18-20% of our budget trying to help him get back on the ballot, money that was gone and that we'll never see again. And so those are just some, like, really short examples. But, I mean, just the fact of going out in July and August to get 2,000 signatures, I would say on average, I did pretty good. 90% of the people in Clayton County, when they answered the door, and if they were home, they typically did, 90% of the people would sign our petition. I mean, most folks were very, very, very friendly in Clayton County on signing our signatures. But you could only get about 25 a day. And I was the candidate. If you wasn't the candidate, you averaged around 15 signatures for about a 6 to 8 hour of going door to door. Because one of the problems you have, and this is at least I am, if I got in there and a little old lady was really interested and she had questions, I didn't leave until they were all answered. So if it took an hour to get a signature, that's what I did. And that's what I told our guys to do. Look, we also got to educate. It's just not to go out here and get on the ballot. Let's talk to these folks and tell them what our views are. So it's very difficult. Then they think, oh, you know, I got to vote for you. No, ma'am. This just means I can be part of the system. I can be part of the game. It doesn't mean come November you have to vote for me. It's just you'll see my name on the ballot. And so, you know, it was very difficult trying to educate folks. And back then in 2002, the word libertarian still confused folks. You know, with the Rand Paul and Ron Paul folks, they've kind of opened it up a little bit, and people have become more educated. Same thing with the Green Party. You know, they think that their pure stance is environment, which is not. You know, but that's what they think when you hear Green Party, you know, which they've got a different view set than just that. So some of the problems you run into is education, but that's more of a party issue that we have to work with.
Well, I think the Green Party is a little bit more, I mean, environmental concerns is part of their platform, and I can't really speak for the Green Party. But I do know that there are actually the Green Party and the Democratic platform, there are a lot of similarities. There was a little chess kind of thing going on Facebook about where you're closely politically aligned to. And a lot of people, and actually it was pretty good, and a lot of people came up with, if they came up progressive, particularly for progressive, they were Democratic, over 90% Democratic and Green. Because Green Party, you know, they're into social justice issues. I don't think it's more than just environment. And I think people need to look at all the parties and the different platforms. The Libertarian platform is one that I believe everyone needs to pay attention to. As a progressive, you know, I do have some problems with the Libertarian platform, find areas where we can find common ground and address things. And
you mean tell you something kind of cool about our when you join our party? When you join the Libertarian Party, you sign an agreement that's called the non-aggression principle. And most people that, if you're not a Libertarian Party, don't realize that. We agree when we join the party, we will never be the aggressor. We will only be the defender. Anytime it's, whether it's political or war or whatever it is, the Libertarian philosophy is we will only be a defender of our rights, not an aggressor at all. which I think says a lot about how you're trying to get power, is that you're not going to use aggression to get power. You will use freedom and volunteerism to get to that point, which is kind of neat. But, you know, one of the other neat things, you're taught those people taking the quizzes. Do you know which two candidates are guys when they take these I Sidewood quizzes? Do you know who they're popping up with right now?
Who?
Bernie Sanders.
Rand Paul.
Those are the two candidates. And those are the two candidates that are popping up on the libertarians that are taking these quizzes. Because Bernie, we all agree with the social issues, generally speaking. The war, the spying, the whole, almost his whole social stuff, most of the libertarians agree with. His economics, he loses it. And then Rand, obviously, he's fairly close to us, generally speaking, anyway. I mean, he loses on a few things, but it's kind of funny to think of Bernie Sanders being their second pick of all the options out there.
I think it's great, and I think it's something that progressives need to look at. You know, usually when you bring up certain names, and I find it, I know a lot of people are probably going to hit me up and give me crap after all of this, but there are some on the left that are mirror images of what we see on the right. And if I bring up certain names, it's like people have a weird form of Tourette's and they just go off. You know, I bring up Rand Paul. Oh, he's a racist. He's this, he's that. And they don't bother to listen to where we can find common ground. I'm not asking you to marry the man. I'm not asking you to sign up for his campaign. I'm not asking you to vote for him. But on that issue, on the issue of criminal justice and the need for reform, there are spaces where we can work together. And I also, you know, I was with the coffee party that was supposed to help facilitate public debate. I still think it's needed. It is very difficult to have conversations in this polarized environment that we have with other people. And we all back up. We all tend to, you know, you got to rep your side. But, you know, we often say things that, you know, we want people to be willing to work across the aisle. No, we don't. We really don't, because the minute someone tries to, we get the pitch, and both sides do it. We get the torches and the pitchfork and, you know, vote them out, or they sold us out, and we're trying to get stuff done. We are real, and this is how it works, how bipartisanship works, and it's not easy, just like, you know, we're seeing with the debate about racism and other issues. It is not easy. But I do appreciate some of the things that libertarians bring to the platform. I don't think I'll be signing up to join the party right yet. But, you know, I really do admire the work that you're doing and the gains that you have made, because out of all the parties in Georgia, probably the libertarians are the best ones, best poised to win office. And you guys have consistently put candidates up there.
Well, you know we were the first ones to run a woman for governor. You know, we're the first people to ever run an African-American for governor, and we were the first woman candidate ever get an electoral college vote.
Wow. See, this I did not know. I did not know all of that.
Yep. John Mons was our candidate. He was the first million vote getter in any third party or any libertarian ever in the nation, John Mons, when he got a million votes a couple of years ago in Georgia.
And didn't he have an African-American candidate for governor? That was him,
John Mons. But
John
he ran for PSC,
okay,
where he got the million votes as the PSC candidate, and then 2 years later he ran for governor for us. And he's an awesome fellow. He homeschools his children. They live down in South Georgia. His wife is a professor at one of the local colleges down there. But he was the first libertarian ever in America to get a million votes.
Wow, that is impressive. That really is impressive. And, I want to see more people's voices in the process. And this is why, you know, I may rep a particular side. I really want to hear and see the other side of the platforms and tables represented. And we've got to find a way to get our legislative body to not be afraid. I mean, my thing is this: if you're like Oz, you are all powerful, all knowing, and, you know, your people are the way and the light and all of that, then why are you afraid of including someone in? What is wrong with competition? that forces you to raise your game up. If your game
another,
is not tight.
Another reason that I would like to see third parties, not only just included on the ballot, but I would like to see some of them get elected, is because one, even though I'm a Democrat, and I support probably 95% of the Democratic platform, I'm not going to say 100 because there's some things that I don't go all the way with. But the thing that scares me the most is one party rule, and when you only have two parties battling it out, sooner or later one is going to eliminate the other. It's just going to happen. That's the laws of nature, okay? But as long as there's multiple parties, then parties have to form coalitions. There's balance. People have to compromise a little bit more. I believe that if we had a couple of Greens and a couple of independents and some libertarians in the Georgia state, in the Georgia General Assembly, we wouldn't get so much craziness out of it, out from under the gold dome. Because the Republicans would not have such a supermajority. There would be no supermajorities. There would be coalitions. There'd be coalitions all over the place because people would have to start talking to each other, and they would shift constantly based on what the people wanted to see. Because that's how you see these European governments operate. You see the Canadians, you see the English, you see the British, the French, the Germans. You know, you see them all reforming coalition governments. You even see it in Israel from time to time, where you see these coalition governments have to take and bend a whole lot to the will of the people because nobody has a majority. And that's good government. Good government
right.
should never be, I'm just getting my way. We can steamroll through. We can screw what the people think. We have enough votes to not even talk to the other side. That is dangerous. That's what happened in Nazi Germany. Hitler got made a coalition with two smaller parties, then eliminated them. Then he went and eliminated everybody else. And when we
I always tell folks, so they're always, you know, it's amazing how many GOP guys call me and say, Doug, you need to get over here and help us. We need to win. I'm like, you guys don't understand. The moment that the Libertarian Party disappears, you guys will change. They're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, you need me there to flank you. You need that push. You need me to stay there and balance you, because if I'm not there to balance you, you're going to go way, way, way far right, or you're going to go way, way crony capitalist on me. And if I'm over here and somebody's listening to my message, or I'm in that debate, they're like, no. We're going to vote for this guy if you're going to be that way. And it happens that way at the state house level. If we had some extra voices, do you think we would have got a $1.1 billion gas tax hike if you'd had a quarter of the people there as libertarians? There would have been a different kind of discussion on that tax hike if the libertarians had been there, or if the Green Party had been there. You would have had a different discussion on that billion-dollar tax hike.
Mm. I think so. I agree with you on that.
We would have had different discussions. We would have had different discussions.
That whole bill was a bunch of deals being made. But one of the things that stood out for me after elections where either the GOP suffered losses or the Democrats suffered losses, and there would be all of these autopsies on the election. And what I heard was a whole lot of, well, it could be this factor, them looking internally and them saying, we did not listen to the voters. And a lot of what was expressed by the voters were either a shift to the right or to the left internally that is better represented by third parties. And I really, really would like voters a chance to express themselves and let the best person win office instead of having, these Sophie's Choice elections, something that I call the fence race quite a bit in Georgia. It was a Sophie's Choice. You know, we were left with vote for Michelle, none or die, on the left. And that was, and you know, a lot of us held our noses and we did it, and she still lost. But, and we heard all, I heard the gamut of blame, you know, really there was no, in this election, there wasn't one where third parties could be blamed because they couldn't get a seat on the table, you know, and it's been difficult. I've watched the Green Party struggle here in Georgia just trying to get on the ballot, and I believe they are working to get a candidate on. I don't want to, you know, I'm not, I've heard rumors, let's put it this way.
Well, speaking since we don't have a representative from the Green Party, I pulled up because I want people to understand, and I'm going to give Greg Doug a chance to go in and do the same thing for the Libertarians. He didn't explain some, but there are 10 key values of the Green Party, and these were originally validated in Denver, Colorado back in June of 2000. Their first key value is grassroots democracy. And they believe that every human being deserves a say in the decisions that affect their lives and not be subject to the will of another. Therefore, we will work to increase public participation at every level of government and to ensure our public representatives are fully accountable to the people who elect them. We will also work to create new types of political organizations which expand the process of participatory democracy by directly including citizens in the decision-making process. Their second one is social justice and equal opportunity. They believe that all persons should have the rights and opportunities to benefit equally from the resources afforded us by society and the environment. We must consciously confront ourselves, our organization, society at large, and barriers such as racism, class oppression, sexism, homophobia, ageism, disability, which act to deny fair treatment and equal justice under the law. And some of these are long, so I'm going to paraphrase some of these. You got ecological wisdom. They believe the human society is meant to understand, operate with an understanding of nature, and be able to support a sustainable society in which resources are utilized in that way. They believe in nonviolence, and they want to develop alternatives to the society's current platforms of violence. They want to militarize. They want to eliminate mass weapons of mass destruction. And they say, without being naive to the intentions of other government, we recognize the need for self-defense and defense of others who are in helpless situations. They promote the nonviolent methods to oppose practices which we disagree and they want to guide the decision-making process of those on a personal, community, and a global level. Decentralization. They believe in community-based economics and economic justice. They believe in feminism and gender equality. They respect diversity. They are for public and global responsibility, personal and global responsibility. And I'm going to read this one out because it's kind of short, but it's interesting. We encourage individuals to act to improve their own personal well-being and at the same time enhance ecological balance and social harmony. We seek to join with other people and organizations around the world to foster peace, economic justice, and health of the planet. And then number 10 is focus, future focus, and sustainability. Now, when I read that, and me always hearing about what the Greens were, it kind of surprised me because I've always been told the Greens are so far left of the Democratic Party. But then at reading that, it's some familiar things I haven't heard from other parties. Doug, you want to tell us about the Libertarians? And then while you're doing that, I'm going to look up the Democratic Socialists.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, it's funny because if you talk to a Democrat, they all think we're right-leaning. The fact is, we're totally different. Everybody looks at left versus right, and we look at tyranny versus liberty. You know, if I'm out running for governor, you know what? I'm going to take as many Democratic votes as I take as Republican votes. You know, the fact is we want smaller government all the time, not just because we want this 10th Amendment stuff or we want this or that. And, you know, we want it because we think at the end of the day that we can do a better job at leaving our lives than the government when it comes to education, when it comes to retirement, when it just about comes to anything at all. I make the assumption that the individual is the ultimate decision maker, never, ever the government. And whenever the government gets in there, as we see in Georgia, then it's a different game. It's, you know, power. It's, you know, distrust. It's all kind of reasons why we end up with this. And, you know, at the end of the day, I want to see less government, not because of any reason other than the fact is I want to see you make your choices. You're going to fail? Yes. You're going to pick yourself back up. Hopefully your neighbor is going to be there and help you, help feed you, you know. And at the end of the day, the Libertarian Party, our main thing is a non-aggression. We want it to be based on voluntary exchange between two people, not a government as the go-between two individuals.
Wow. And, you know, there's something I want to bring up because, you know, I often hear those on the right side of the aisle say, we are the party of smaller government. And that is assuming that all on the left are not for that, and that's simply not true. We do believe in government. There are some on the right who don't believe in government at all, yet it's kind of hypocritical because they say that while they are responsible for exploding the role of government in our lives. But there are most people on the left, we want government to run efficiently. We want it to be as small as possible, but we see it as a necessary element. And I think many times the right is vilified. We want big government, you know, we're floating this, and we really do want a fiscally conservative government. We really don't want to see the waste of tax dollars.
You know, I think it's funny because I talk to folks, and I'll sit down and I say, look, guys, before we sit here and we make decisions on what party we're all in, let's talk about what do we want. We all want better schools, right? We all want better retirement. We all want better cars. We all want, you know, and you can go down this, you know, we want better colleges for our grandchildren. You can go down this list, and I think whether you're Republican, Democrat, Green Party, Libertarian, I think we all say, you know what, Doug, you're right. We want safer schools. We want better schools. We want better education. And now let's sit down and work some of these ideas together and move forward and say, okay, let's at least give this a chance over here and try it. If it don't work, let's move on. And I think sometimes that's what we forget is that everybody's like, okay, I want it my way or no way. And I think sometimes we got to sit down and try multiple items to see which one works better. Now, in the end, I am one of those guys that borderline on zero government because what's happened is I've come to this conclusion that all taxation is thievery and that basically the only way I would run a government would be if it was based on a voluntary basis, would be either through donations or user fees. And not because I think that it would be the best way to run a government, because I think it would be the most moral way to run a government. Because at any moment that I take money from you, whether it's a dollar or $1 million, I've stole from you. And if I beat you seven days a week and I reduce it down to one day a week, I'm still an immoral person. So I'm not looking for tax cuts. I'm looking to get rid of taxes. And not because they don't sometimes buy good things or things that make us happier, but because of the way that we acquire the taxes in the first place is through theft, through force, through the end of a gun, through a tank, through an F-16, through a battleship, through an aircraft carrier. And that's the problem I run into is now that I don't like nice paved roads, I just don't like being stole. You know, it's kind of like me stealing your television. Even if I take that money and give it to my other neighbor to pay for his kid's college, even if that was awesome, at the end of the day, you're missing your TV and it wasn't morally right for me to take your TV. Even though now the other neighbor whose kids I just sent through college loves me to death, it was immoral for me to make that decision.
Well,
you know,
I've always found it interesting. Go ahead,
Scott. Well, I've always found it interesting that when you've talked about that, this is the first time I've actually heard you verbalize. I've read what you've written on that, and now hearing you verbalize that, it was like because I don't like taxes. I always look at them as a necessary evil. I don't like the fact that when I get paid, that all these government entities have their hand in my paycheck before it even reaches my bank account. Now the only thing that comes out voluntarily out of my check is when I put in for my 401k. Now I understand. I love Social Security Administration. I love it. Okay, because I'm down with that. There's a lot of things that taxes, like you say, pay for that I'm cool with. I love my payroll. I'm glad that there's a police force. I wish they could do better about how they police us. I'm definitely a friend of the firefighter. You know, I like my affordable health care. But when you just said that, you know, money's taken away from somebody else, because if I don't pay my taxes, the government is coming to look for me. They're going to put a lien on my property and take it all. Even if it's more, even if the property that I have is worth more than the taxes that I owe, they're going to take and sell my property at reduced rate just to get that amount. Let's say I owe them $70,000 and I own $350,000 home. They will take my $350,000 home and sell it for $75,000 just to get that. Don't care. They're not going to sell it for $350,000 and see my property back.
You know what else? You know what else I hate, Scout? You know, my shop's in East Point where I grew up, and I moved it back there. Even though I live nowhere near East Point, I moved it back there because that's where I grew up. When I walk into Walmart, I see a young single mom struggling at $9 an hour. So she would have brought home $360. Instead, she brings home $272. And she's got to go back down to the county and say, sir, can I please have some food stamps? Can you please give me some food stamps? How demeaning is that? If she had brought home all $360, she may not have needed the food stamps. But what they've done now is they've set it up where she has to go back and beg and be submissive for her own money back. And what does that do to her thought process of what kind of person she is? And, you know, the other thing is her dad would be making more money, and her sister and her brother would be making more money. But at some point when you have to beg for food stamps back while you're being taxed, to me it's like, oh, my God, that's so demeaning, that's so belittling, where the lady might be able to make it on her own. And then there would be folks like us who might would help her anyway. I mean, you know, we do all kind of programs at our shop where we try to do those kind of things. But it's just a really horrible system that we get into when we're basically making somebody like her come back and beg for her money back.
Well, I think the first demeaning thing is that anybody who works and who works hard for an honest living, I don't think that most people, you know, who are working at Walmart, actually, there's a lot of people there who have degrees who never dreamed that they would end up working at Walmart. So, you know, this is a very nuanced conversation we're having here and kind of delves into it. But I think the big point is the fact that she's working and her wages aren't enough, because even if you put those taxes back into her check, she's still not making enough to provide the basic food, shelter, and other things. It still does not keep up with the cost of living. But in terms of taxes, we live in a collective society, and we have things that are shared, okay? We all use roads. There are certain services that we expect, and they have to be paid for. So, you know, in terms of taxes, I really don't care for it. You know, it's more of a jack because, you know, I don't even get to see it. You just take it. But I have to ask both of you, would you willingly give that money up if you were asked to give it up? If it wasn't taken for you and you were just presented a bill and said, you know, payable when due, most people wouldn't pay. So the government has a mechanism to make sure, you know, state, local, and federal governments have that mechanism. As much as we dislike it, they could come up with a gun and say, give us your money. They don't do that, and that's a little bit of hyperbole to use that, you know, analogy with the gun and everything, because that's not what they do.
But in instances like this, though, I'm playing devil's advocate here. Now, we know if I don't pay my taxes, what they do is they seize my property. Now, this is where the government comes in. Let's say the IRS comes to seize my property, right? And when they show up to my house, I tell them, no, you're not coming into my house and you're not going to. They don't show up with suitcases and suits on. They show up with flat jackets and the sheriff and some federal folks with some guns in their hand. I have seen them take property. When the man he has a gun.
I've seen them just, the way I've seen them operate is you go to the bank and you deposit something and they give you a receipt back and say thank you. But, you know, I've unless it is someone, it's, I think it's very rare, and people get caught up by the IRS all the time.
Well, you know, for me, it's, you know, obviously my thought process is a little bit more wacky, and I will tell you, capitalism has been a little bit better to me than the average person. So my tax bill's a little higher than most folks. So in a sense, yeah, I could definitely, myself could pay those bills and pay my own streets and that. And, you know, I already sent my kids to private schools. But to me, is I would like to see another system that we try to work, because I think at the end of the day, if those resources are already there, we should be able to figure out how to get them through a voluntary system. I mean, those resources are already being accumulated, so they're already in existence. And I'd much rather have it where you had a police force in Griffin where I live. If they were being paid by me and you on a voluntary basis and they started doing a bad job, which they do sometimes, they would respond faster if me and you decided not to pitch in on that bill at the end of the month because the way they were treating the young black kids in Griffin because of the war on drugs. Or, you know, some of the other, who they were pulling over quicker and faster because of certain things. You know what? Me and you both would be much quicker to say, you know what? I don't think I want to support this police force. I think we need new leadership. When they get new leadership, I'll start cutting that check again. Right now, you know what? They don't change. They're not going to. And 100 years in the city of Griffin, 100 years in the city of East Point, the police forces are acting identical, and they do not respond to the average taxpayer. And I think if they had to respond to the average donor, I think we might have a different type of system at the end of the day. I don't know if it would be better or worse, but it would be different.
That's an interesting and provocative thought, but, I mean, let's just face it. If we, 99.9% of laws would go away immediately if we as a society learned how to just act right and do the right thing. The reason we have laws is that because of whether it's the inherent nature of man, some of us out here are unable to do that. And not everyone is going to pay their fair share. The Pilgrims found that out very quickly. So we've got to be able to support these systems in a way. And I don't like paying taxes. I don't think anybody does. But I can tell you this. If it was left up to a mandatory system, no, I ain't got it. I'm not going to pay it. So then we create something that doesn't have a funding mechanism. And I don't really see too many ways
It starts like America before the Constitution with the Articles of Confederation. The federal government couldn't do nothing. And you had situations in which people needed for them to do something. And they
but then the have and the have not.
And then you had to go to
the
state.
The have and the have not. Those who can afford
right.
will have it, and those who can't.
You had the larger states being pissed off because the smaller states couldn't kick in, and, you know, so therefore, oh, we're not going to do it because it's not, you know, it's not helping my economy. It's only helping the Southerners, or it's only helping the Northerners, and this, that, and the other. So I can understand both arguments. I don't want nobody coming to my house taking my stuff. I don't want nobody taking nothing from me. But at the same time, you're right, Stacey. The inherent nature of man is to be selfish. I mean, that's just what it is. If that wasn't the case, before we had large government, we had small bands going around trying to steal other villages. Then they would collect a couple of villages, you know, become a tribe. Then next thing you know, they go try to take on somebody else's tribe. They would subdue them, and then they became nations in states. It's just crazy.
Well, I think the only argument I would make against where you're going with that one, Scott, is currently today who has killed more people in the last 10 years than any one organization? Who's responsible for more deaths?
What government
in particular? It's the U.S.
Yeah.
government.
And then you can also look at who has
perpetrated the most racist acts in the last 10 to 20 years. It's the U.S. government and its subsidiaries. And to me, that's where I worry is that when we look down at the people who are actually the bad guys, it's the folks who are doing this collection of our taxes, and they're not answering to us. And hopefully we're going to see a change. I mean, hopefully we're making a turn here, and we're going to see that. I think, and this is something that's awesome, I thought cameras everywhere was going to be bad for liberty. It has actually been awesome for liberty. Because it used to be that only the government had cameras to watch us. Cameras are getting so cheap now, we get to watch the government. And it is amazing how many times now we get 14 angles of the cops choking a guy out for selling 25-cent cigarettes. And we all realize now there's something wrong, guys. Okay, if this cameras hadn't been here, it would have been, oh, this 300-pound guy was fighting us and had a stick. No, he didn't. That's not what it looks like on the video with 14 different views. The guy was sitting there trying to make a small living, not messing with anybody. And all of a sudden, you've got 14 guys choking him out. I know that argument
probably comes down to the top of what the libertarians want to, because tobacco is one of those tax products that if you sell illegally, the government gets all out of their tizzy about it, because you sold a cigarette without a tax certificate.
Yep, and you know, the fact is, I think that fellow had actually paid the taxes on the cigarettes when he bought the pack originally from CVS, and he was reselling it. They just wanted the next set of taxes on those cigarettes. He'd already paid taxes when he bought them. He would just brought the pack down and was selling them individually. But you see this over and over. You're seeing it with Uber and you're seeing it with Lyft, is that the government's worried about losing control and part of its power and part of its taxation. But also, one thing to think about, guys, is why with the Federal Reserve and the ability to write money at will, why are we taxed so high? We're spending so much money from the Federal Reserve that's not come from taxes. Why do we even have taxes if the Federal Reserve can just print dollars at will? So then all of a sudden, they're already spending 80% of the money we're spending coming from the Federal Reserve.
And seeing that the currency is fiat anyway and has nothing backing in the value, you make a very good point, Deb. You make a good point.
Well, I mean, we could talk about a couple of things it's not just money. We put value on houses. What do houses, the raw material of houses, we put a dollar amount, we assign a dollar amount to everything. So, I mean, we assign a value to a house. What makes, you know, we have houses that are more valuable that are basically made of the same thing that you would find in another house, is primarily because of we put value on the land the house is sitting on. So if we're going to talk about how some paper and ink becomes valuable, we have to talk about how everything does, because we have assigned a dollar value to every single thing on this planet.
Yep. You guys, you know how much the newest aircraft carrier that we just bought, you know how much it cost?
Probably a whole lot of zeros. I could not envision.
$13 billion. Do you know how many people? Okay, if you were buying a house at $200,000 a piece, do you know how many families could have lived if we had bought houses with that aircraft carrier?
I'll take a $90,000 house.
Right, but if it was a $200,000 house.
But that's part of the issue when we talk about
55,000 houses could have been bought at $200,000 a piece for what we paid for that one aircraft carrier. 250,000 Americans.
And we don't talk about that. When we have conversations about debt and government spending, we never talk about the military spending that the government does. And which eats up quite a bit more.
Healthcare and Social Security.
Right. And we always default to, you know, it's the poor people or the people who have paid into a system. That's your money.
Do you know how many countries we have to add together after America to equal our budget? 26 countries. The next 26 countries combined has the same budget we have. 21 of those are our friends.
But that's not something we talk about. When we have the discourse, we don't talk about it.
See, that's where the libertarians and the Democrats are more eye to eye, is because I see family homes being absorbed into the military budget. And it takes a few steps to get to that point. But at the end of the day, what I see is families struggling to have a decent place to live. Well, I see $13 billion aircraft carriers floating out of the sea, attacking brown countries that we have no reason to be in attacking.
But then you talk about that same military budget, and then you go to a small segment of the population, which is the military families we have. And you look at the fact that you have military families on food stamps, And then you have military families having a problem finding decent housing. And you have military families who have a problem with getting, even though they have free universal health care, have a hard time getting decent health care. And so you figure I'm spending $13 billion on an aircraft carrier, but the 5,000 sailors, and me and you both, Doug, that served in the Navy, the 5,000 sailors who are on board that ship are having a sucky life while serving our nation.
We're heading to 1991, the USS Texas, a billion-dollar nuclear-powered ship that I was on, heading to the Gulf War. What are we worried about prior to the war beginning? We're worried about all kind of chemical attacks. All right, I'm on the firefighting team, and the question I ask the chief petty officer, does my equipment protect me from a chemical attack? We don't know. What do you mean you don't know? We've got a billion-dollar ship here. You don't know if my $40 outfit's enough to protect me to keep running the ship? We've never done those tests, Petty Officer Craig. We don't know. But we did spend $1 billion to push this piece of steel through the water, but we have no idea if you, the human being, is protected well if we go to battle.
That was
just unbelievable.
We have really, really, we kind of digressed a bit, but it's been a great conversation.
This is one of the points we make here on Down South and Dirty. We brought a third party in, okay? And see the conversation that happens when you get to talking about what third parties believe in. And you start finding out, well, dang, you get all kinds of great information. You will never find this in mainstream media. You will never find mainstream, and this is one of the reasons why we didn't go and default to what was on the mainstream radar in this show this Sunday is because everybody else is talking about it. We're being distracted from the major issues. Like we just said, we got a military budget that eclipses 26 of the next countries, and 20 of those countries are our allies. Who are we defending ourselves from? And we can take that one aircraft carrier and house people. And if they don't have to be $200,000 homes. They could have been $30,000, $40,000 homes and people learn how to live a little tighter like we did when we were growing up, because I grew up in a house with one bathroom. I mean, now kids, you talk about, that's three bathrooms and people still complaining.
I had to tell my daughter the other day we had a window unit. It was a big deal when we got our first window unit, and we moved it. We moved it, like, at breakfast, you went to the kitchen. Then we put it in the TV room. Then my mom got it for the night's sleep. And then we actually went to bed with the windows open. And you know, this is 1985. This ain't that long ago. And we were excited because we had a window unit.
I'm real old school. Until I got married, the only air conditioning I knew was a fan in the window. And I learned real quick how to point it going out to suck the hot air out and to turn it around to bring the cool air in. And I still do that to this day because I like fresh air. But Doug, real quick, Libertarian Party, how can we contact the Libertarian Party in Georgia?
Well, the best way is to go to our Facebook page. If you just type in Libertarian Party of Georgia on Facebook, we will come up. We have a super active Facebook. If you message the admin, that's me. If you want to friend me, Doug Craig, I'll come up. I've got my two little girls with me, and it'll be obvious all the Democrats and Republicans I have as friends. But if we also have a number, 404-888-9468. It's a way to call the office. We have a office at 1776 Peachtree Street. So it's very easy. Georgia's, we're one of the top Libertarian parties in the country. Very active. Like I said, we run great candidates. We know how to run TV ads and radio ads. So we're a little bit different level than most third parties throughout the country. But check us out. Like I said, you're definitely going to hear something different from us. And hopefully here in about 2.5 years, you guys are going to see me up there on stage debating as the governor candidate for Georgia.
All right. And I'm going to try to put the links of all the parties that are active in Georgia. There's the Justice Party. There are the Greens. There's the Libertarians. And of course, you know the big two. So,
by the way, the Green Party is answering questions. If you go to their Facebook page and message them, they do respond. They are active because I've talked to them here lately about ballot access.
I know they're active and I know they're busy. I wish they could have joined us today, but I'd invite anybody to join us in further conversations because they really need to get their voice out there. I'll put some links up on the Down South and Dirty page. We're on Facebook at Down South and Dirty. Just search for us and checked out. We got, what, about a minute left?
We got actually 15 seconds. So everybody is down and dirty. See y'all again next time. We'll be talking about the Constitution.
Ooh, this is going to be a hot one, y'all.
Mm-hmm.